It's the Wonky Show. We've been at Labour conference this week where we got a radical rethink of the 50% target. Bridget Phillipson revived maintenance grants, the levy on international students' fees stays, all the framing, the politics and the vibes. It's all coming up.
We will scrap that target and replace it with a new ambition that two-thirds of our children should go either to university or take a gold standard apprenticeship.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to eat a curled-up sandwich with a tumbler of warm white wine, as usual, three excellent guests. In Durham, Gary Hughes is Chief Exec at Durham Students' Union. Gary, your highlight of the week, please.
It's been the freshest week in Durham this week, Jim, but my highlight is actually a former contributor to the site, Talitha from the Leicester University Centre for Hate Studies, is doing some research at Durham into student experiences of harassment. I'm having a coffee with her after this, and I think that will be my highlight of the week.
Brilliant stuff. In southeast London, Eve Alcock is Director of Public Affairs at the QAA. Eve, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight is way less exciting than Gary's, but I had the best Korean food in Liverpool at Labour Party conference, and I'm still dreaming about it.
And still in Liverpool, stealing tote bags from the exhibition centre, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, my highlight, definitely really looking forward to getting back and seeing my family. It's been, you know, interesting times at the conference, but yeah, there's nothing quite like going home and not being at conference anymore.
So yes, it get quiet. So yes, we start this week with Keir Starmer. Tuesday saw the Prime Minister take to the stage after a rough few weeks. And Michael, we got a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, it sort of rumours began to build kind of overnight and in the morning that, you know, Starmer was going to pronounce on, you know, the iconic Tony Blair 50% higher education target, which, you know, was never really enshrined in policy, but, you know, is very, very famous, very well known. You know, probably one of the big things people know about New Labour and higher education was that they were trying to, you know, get more people to go, even though the growth in higher education began much earlier. But yeah, Starmer, despite 2 years ago at conference saying that he was sort of, you know, indicating he was very committed to this, he sort of said it's not right for our times to be thinking about, you know, trying to get 50% of young people into some form of higher education, which was what the Blair target was, and he's replaced it. We've got a new one, which is two-thirds of young people participating in higher level learning. That could be, according to how DfE has framed it, academic, technical, or apprenticeships by age 25. You know, he sort of said this will help with parity of esteem, that if we, you know, if the government's target, despite it not, as I said, not really ever being a kind of formal target they were sort of measuring their progress towards, but if that's what the government's focusing on, it's sort of doing down, you know, the people like his dad and, you know, all the others that don't feel university is right for them. And yeah, the revised approach will help to sort of build higher skills in all these different areas. And there's also a kind of sub-target within there. They've said by 2040, they want at least 10% of young people doing higher technical education, sort of HTQs, that kind of thing, or apprenticeships, again, by age 25.
Well, fascinating stuff. Let's hear a clip.
While you will never hear me denigrate the aspiration to go to university, I don't think the way we currently measure success in education, that ambition to get 50% of kids to uni, I don't think that's right for our times. Because if you're a kid or a parent of a kid who chooses an apprenticeship, what does it say to you? Do we genuinely, as a country, afford them the same respect? Because we should. But I can't help feeling that my dad was right. So conference, today I can announce we will scrap that target and replace it with a new ambition that two-thirds of our children should go either to university or take a gold standard apprenticeship.
Well, I mean, there were lots of clap lines. That was one of them. Gary, you'll have been watching that in an hour off from Freshers Week. Thoughts?
I mean, what an odd place to crap. But yeah, I mean, it's as Michael said, it's never been an official target, but it has had a totemic status, particularly for the Labour Party, who have, you know, always positioned themselves as the party of aspiration. Things that stood out for me in the clip, Jim, and certainly some of the press afterwards, is that the two-thirds of people taking part in higher education, in higher learning, let's use that phrase, of course, doesn't just include kids. This has got to be thought of in the context of the lifelong learning entitlement and the fact that adult learning has got to be part of whatever the government is devising for lifelong learning. So we can't just think about this as when people finish compulsory education going into something. Like this, the solutions that the government have got to be reading for have got to be thinking about retraining, and you know, we say that all the time. But it does make me think about what a gold standard apprenticeship is. I think that universities and the higher education sector are absolutely going to be part of that. Like, they already are. This isn't about saying that FE, which got a lot of attention across conference, is the solution to this. Instead of higher education, it's going to have to be a whole tertiary education approach towards achieving Keir's vision. That won't be new to, you know, the approach taken in Wales. It certainly tried to accommodate some of that thinking. So I think it's to be welcomed. I expect that the, as we'll talk about, the devil will be in a lot of the detail, but I think it should be something that we should celebrate as a sector. It's a commitment to higher education without feeling the need to attack the institutions and the people delivering it. What a refreshing change.
I mean, the thing is, we've kind of heard the scrapping of the 50% target several times over the years, haven't we? So, you know, I was reading this morning a speech from David Cameron in 2015 where he said, either apprenticeships or universities for almost everybody. And that was 2015. Why does this, you know, this desire to scrap the 50% target keep popping back up?
I was reading the same David Cameron speech this morning. In all honesty, I think it just, look, it's narrative, isn't it? And it signals sort of ambition, and that's fine and that's good. But the reality is that successive governments have struggled with this divide in the perception of prowess between academic and sort of technical education. And despite successive governments trying to either balance one over the other in kind of pursuit of equity or parity. So I am just intrigued to see how this sort of policy development continues, to see if there's any real shift or step change that we can see in this government's vision for how they're going to achieve that target that feels different from all of the times that people have tried to shift this parity previously. You know, it's a laudable target, though it's unclear what gold standard means in the context of apprenticeships. And it's understandable that they're focusing on that sort of participation. But as we in the HE sector say all the time, it doesn't really matter what the participation rate is unless students are also being really effectively supported to succeed once they are in. So for me, it's the target's fine, the ambition is good, the devil will be in the detail.
When Tony Blair was saying this for the first time in the late 90s, he was sort of speaking to parents, right? And saying, you know, we want, if you want your kids to go to university, we're going to enable that to happen. And in the last decade or more now, the political messaging basically is just targeted at people who are like 70 and they don't have kids that, you know, are maybe going to go to university in the future. In many cases, they have kids who went to university and now don't call as much as they want. And they're just, you know, then it's not that sort of aspiration that they're targeting anymore. It's more, you know, obviously, you know, there's some genuine sort of popular concern for sort of, you know, higher level skills for people getting into graduate jobs and things. But I do think it's also just a real bellwether of how much politics has changed in terms of who politicians in all parties are really sort of trying to pin their messages on.
But Gary, just on the politics of all of that, if in the Blair era, the message was, you could all be middle class. If anything, wandering around the event this week, the sense was that no, we could all be working class.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Keir Starmer did say in his speech he will make no apologies, Jim, for his focus on working people. And I think that will be interesting to see how it plays out. Because, of course, you know, when, as Michael was saying, Blair spoke about this, apprenticeships and further education were for working class people. They were going to go on to be skilled labourers, but still labourers. And there was a suggestion that that was undesirable, unsustainable, and actually, why shouldn't working class kids go and study politics? You know, I was a beneficiary of that policy. I do think what, as ever, will be interesting is the two-thirds of people going into apprenticeships. I actually think this would be really interesting to understand how middle-class kids will view this as suitable for their children, depending on what those gold-plated apprenticeships are. Because I don't think we now conceive of apprenticeships as being things which are electrical or plumbing or that sort of stuff. We view them as things like accountancy or software design or what else? Things that are previously you would have needed to go to higher education for. But people, I think, why do I need a dissertation in accounting? What is the benefit of me sitting a presentation in my lecture theatre if I'm going to be a software engineer? So I do think it will, the funding that will follow it, one assumes, it will be an interesting topic about what sort of learning is for who, just because so many people will be caught up in it.
Michael, the other person that whose speech I was rereading was the boss, right? So Mark Leach's podcast on the eve of the publication of the Augur review. Let's have a quick listen to that.
Complexity theory might go some way to explaining the decades-long failure to create a coherent post-18 education system. After all, it's not for want of trying. Politician after politician, decade after decade, we've had a pledge to break the binary divide between vocational and academic education.
So let us remove one by one Britain's biggest educational and employment handicaps. As Alan Johnston proposes, give vocational qualifications parity of esteem with academic qualifications.
Well, I think the important thing is that we've got to establish genuine parity of esteem.
They all promise to turn the UK into the next Germany, to not waste talent. And yet for all the time and treasure spent on it, we keep ending up back at square one. Arguably, higher education has had an outstanding run compared to further education.
It does feel like this is a government that's finally getting round to implementing the Augur review.
Yeah, and you've written that on the site as well, Jim, and I think that's very sort of sensibly observed. You know, Augur sometimes has a reputation of, oh, it just got ignored, it didn't happen. But, you know, I think probably when we look back, you know, if we're in the mood to look back wherever we are in sort of 10, 20 years, we'll sort of see that actually, you know, this big review and the framing of, you know, tertiary within it has proved slowly and, you know, some might even say glacially influential in lots of areas. We're going to talk about grants and things like that later. I mean, the thing Gary said quite a while ago, which I think is an important point, you know, Augur was thinking about, you know, throughout life. That's where the sort of genesis of the LLE is, that people need to be able to return to, you know, higher level skills training throughout their careers. And the target is 2/3 of young people participating by age of 25. You know, we don't know really anything about the policy yet, except for that thing about age, which is, you know, quite important to pay attention to, especially if they sort of think the LLE is a mechanism for achieving this, because, you know, all through its kind of development, it's been framed as I said, sort of, you know, returning to work later in life, you know, flexible one-stop tickets where you can hop on, hop off, that kind of thing. You know, say with apprenticeships, right? If they, you know, they want 10% of people doing apprenticeships or higher technical education, there is no money left in the apprenticeships budget now. It's all being spent. It even was slightly overspent, I think, this year. The only way they can really achieve that, unless they're going to put up the apprenticeships levy, which I really don't see happening, the only way they can achieve that is by disincentivizing older people to take apprenticeships, as they've done with level 7. Are they going to need to do more of that in future? You know, maybe if they box themselves into a corner with, you know, we've got a target for people under 25.
So Eve, here's my theory, which is Keir Starmer's speech would have got an even weirder clapline if he'd have said, our new lifelong learning entitlement will enable an expansion of level 4 and 5 sub-degree qualifications, but we are expecting the higher education sector to expand level 4 and 5 sub-degree qualifications in moderately technical and scientific areas. But broadly, that's where we're going to get to, isn't it? That's what's going to be central.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what do you mean that the general public aren't au fait with the levels outlined in the FHEQ, Jim? That's sacrilege. Yeah, it is going to be vital. But there's something interesting about how employers in the public perceive, I suppose, level 4 and 5 qualifications, because they are considered more non-traditional. People are less familiar with the concepts. And look,
just aren't that many other. I mean, you know what I mean?
No, quite. And so there's going to be a bit of work that needs to be done to really convey what the sort of tangible value of those are, so that so that it becomes a really helpful and important pathway for young people entering into higher learning. You know, part of this is about making really clear the different pathways available to young people and that parity thing that we spoke about earlier. But, you know, again, it just feels to me like it's good. It's, you know, it's laudable. It's a good idea. I just, maybe I'm just feeling in a skeptical phase at the moment, but I would like to see how it plays out.
Larry, I guess one of my other reflections is, right, so, and you know, a bit earlier on in the speech, Starmer drew the usual, and I say usual because, again, you know, this has been in so many people's speeches over the years on all sorts of sides of the political fence, the kind of differentiation between head and hand, you know, going to university and then, you know, being the tool maker. But, you know, as such, what really strikes me is we're still in a position where people can't see all of the higher technical work going on in the higher education sector. You know, people in their head imagine that going to university is everybody studying gender studies and writing dissertations. That we've got this real problem, haven't we, since 1992 onwards, where nobody seems to have been able to convince the public that you can do really interesting and important, you know, I don't know, motor vehicle engineering in higher education.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things which I think you've picked out in the start, Jim, is the importance of how employers respond, particularly to apprenticeships. I mean, 20-odd years ago, my mom was she had been a care worker for many years in hospitals in Birmingham and did a nursing apprenticeship. It wasn't called that. But UCE offered courses where they help people become nurses after 2 years, didn't need to do a dissertation, and she went on to practice and had a great career. But is nursing an apprenticeship? You wouldn't think in that way. But if we're going to help this apprentice, you know, if the sector is going to help apprenticeship goal take off, we've got to be thinking about how employers understand that training on the job in their workforce can be apprenticeship led and that their sector is somewhere that can lend to it. The challenge, I think, of course, is that government commonly is not the best friend of the business lobby, and that is a reasonably well reported. Rachel Reeves's actions are perhaps not helping Bridget Phillipson's policy initiatives. But I can't think that the solution to that has got to be through employment rather than through higher education. Higher education will be providing the learning, but the apprenticeship partnership has got to be with employers and the sector there. So it'd be really interesting. I think I've read lots of education press responses to this. I've read less business press yet because I don't think they've quite got their heads around how that will work. But you're right, that head and hand divide can't be sustained. But I think we've got to see the sectors where the apprenticeships can thrive, promote themselves, appearing that in accounting and software engineering and aircraft design, actually these can be apprenticeship-led forms of education, and actually a academic, like training to be an academic as if you're going to go on to be a professor of software engineering, is silly. Like, it's a job. Go do it in a workplace.
Yes, yes. Interesting. Now, Michael, around the fringe, Jackie Smith very much signaled that the white paper is, you know, I mean, it's in right round, isn't it? You know, we are, that doesn't necessarily mean we'll get it in the next couple of days. That could be a month or so, but it's coming, isn't it? And, you know, we did get some clues as to what will be in it.
Where you end up shouldn't be determined by where you start. Your background doesn't determine your future. But that needs all of us to take action to make sure that that isn't the case. It means tackling the disadvantage gap early on. It means investing in excellent state education. It means ensuring that young people are ready to make choices, that they've got the right advice and guidance in front of them, including at the point at which they're making choices much earlier on in their school life about which subjects to study. We know from the polling that 67% of applicants feel anxious about choosing the right university and 65% about picking the right subject. And that tells us something important, that information, advice and guidance isn't just something that's nice to have, it's essential.
Yeah, as you say, it's got to go through three different secretaries of state. Now, obviously, the Science Department, Department for Work and Pensions, and DfE will all be sort of putting their comments in. And Jackie Smith at a King's Policy Institute fringe did sort of I think spell out in, I think gave a pretty good overview, maybe aside from the research side of things, of sort of what the narrative is going to be in it. Not so much the policy levers, but, you know, it's going to be essentially these things we've been talking about. It, you know, it gels exactly with Starmer's speech. It's going to be about level 4 and 5. It's going to be HEFE collaboration. Obviously, there's going to be lots about sort of level 3 qualifications in there as well. But yeah, I mean, what we don't quite know is exactly what's going to be done policy-wise, even potentially legislation-wise. But, you know, I think I wouldn't be too surprised if there's not actually that much policy within the white paper, as kind of mad as that sounds. I think to a degree, what we're seeing is the government is kind of setting out a narrative that they would like the sector to adhere to, you know, talking about, you know, local, regional, retaining graduates, working with employers, working a bit more collaboratively. And they're sort of saying to the sector, you know, if you can do these things and show you're doing things and talk about them, then we'll give you the political cover for it. And we'll be sort of grateful to the extent that, you know, we can then take credit for some of it. And it's sort of saying, you know, this is what we'd like universities to sort of appear like in the public imagination. Will you go ahead and get on board with this?
Yes, I guess the sort of partly ominous, but partly exciting, I guess it depends the angle you're coming from, partly ominous, partly exciting line for me was when she said, Patrick Vallance and I have thought about and talked about it, and we'll have more to say about what we think that means for the nature of the HE sector, where I think we should, one, recognise diversity, two, celebrate that and not expect every institution to be delivering exactly the same, and three, encourage institutions to think about their specialisms and focus on them. And obviously there's this backdrop, isn't there, Gary, of UKRI kind of half nudging universities to focus on, you know, the research they're good at and all of that kind of thing. And I really was taken back to thinking about some of those European cities we've been to on the study tours where, you know, students can take modules from 2 or 3 universities in a city and build their degree. I mean, is that where we're going?
Potentially. I think the interesting thing, two things occur to me from that, Jim. One of which is that specialism in itself isn't incentivized. Actually, the LSE, for example, is pretty damn specialist, but there are a number of policy conditions which are, you know, not working in their favor at the minute. And the fact that they are already specialists won't reward them in any particular way compared to Imperial. Like, I think it will have to be an understanding that specialism enables more distinct market advantage. It perhaps allows access to different pots of funding, different, particularly in research, but potentially from industry or from philanthropy. But in and of itself, it's not clear that that is actually a survival tactic or a thriving tactic. It's just, it makes a form of sense because it remove some of the competitive imperative. But in and of itself, I think that is a phrase that's used a lot, which I'm not actually sure is backed up by any meaningful incentive. The other thing I think is just the distribution of HE in the UK is very interesting. There is still, you know, I love working at Durham, but it is a place-based institution. Like, you come here to be here. And actually, as much as there would be advantage perhaps to gaining some credit from a university that is much more focused on some of the heavy sciences, perhaps, or medicine even, which we don't teach, how would that be achieved where we are so place-based and in the UK so dependent on infrastructure for transport that is poor, housing that is poor? So I think there are massive challenges to that. Is it desirable? Yes. And does specialism, more specialist institutions facilitate it? Definitely. But again, I think that's where a call for HE to act just isn't backed up by the rest of the sector, by the rest of the public sector, I mean, in terms of the infrastructure necessary to sustain it.
Yeah. And actually, funnily enough, Eve, right, so just as she was saying that, I was kind of, you know, doom scrolling through my feed. And one of the things I'd spotted was, you know, a large Russell Group university has taken on a lot of students this September and is struggling to meet its accommodation guarantee, where students will end up living, you know, 3/4 of an hour, hour and a half away, sort of thing. And I guess to some extent, if we end up with in the white paper policy levers that are just the same as we've always had, which is, you know, we'll improve information, advice and guidance, we'll enable students to make choices and so on. It doesn't change some of the fundamental big changes we've seen over the past couple of years to student numbers distribution, does it?
No, I think you're right. And I think to be honest, it's symptomatic for me of a broader danger with this forthcoming white paper, that you have government, as Michael says, setting out effectively their sort of narrative and vision for the sector. And you have a sector, and Sacha Rose-Neal said this actually at an event at the at Labour conference, where effectively you've got a system that in lots of different ways is a little bit broken and therefore hamstrung on delivering on what that vision should look like, because it's sort of entrenched into, you know, awkward policy incentives and the need to just stay afloat in favour of, you know, thinking about the things that much of the sector want to be thinking about. And I feel frustrated that we're in this sort of position, to be honest, because I think the sector would love nothing more than for that white paper to come out and them to be really agile and creative in thinking through what that white paper means for their institutional context and, you know, educational strategy and all of that sort of thing. And I just worry that without a government that has basically the money to shore up the financial sustainability of the sector in a way that allows for that thinking, then the gap between vision and execution off the back of the white paper might be quite large.
Michael, did we get any sort of little hints on financial sustainability, even bits of mood music?
I mean, I think there was a bit of mood music, sure, you know, and I think it's notable. Okay, let's put it like this. I think it's notable, say, for example, that Bridget Phillipson and I think Jackie Smith as well, you know, when they're asked about financial sustainability, they point about the fact that they announced the one-off fee rise last year. Therefore, I think we can intuit from that is where they see, you know, the government's role in enabling financial sustainability, really. I mean, a bit that they'll mention sort of refocus the office for students, this kind of thing. But, you know, I think that and potentially some things around the use of maintenance grants, which we might talk about a bit later, it also, you know, perhaps indicates that there's appetite, and this is where they're going with this, and they're sort of softening the ground a bit for announcing further fee rises in England, which, you know, I don't think there's any indication that any of the other sorts of asks are really coming together. You know, if you think where we were sort of a year ago or before the election, and there was sort of talk about, you know, the need for a transformation pot or sort of, you know, loans from the government to the sector that could be spent on changing business model, none of that. We never hear anything about that. I think, you know, to the extent which the government addresses financial sustainability, the way it will do it will be through allowing tuition fees to rise.
Right, well, interesting. All sorts of stuff on all of that on the site. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Per Hampshire, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about trust in higher education. Trust is the foundation of all meaningful relationships, and in universities, it's what connects students, staff, communities, and partners. But in times of uncertainty and challenge, trust can falter, leading to disengagement and doubt. So how do we build trust? It starts with care, accountability, and everyday experiences. From classrooms to leadership, trust grows when people feel seen, heard, and valued. Research shows that students trust institutions that prioritise their well-being, even when individual experiences vary. Trust also enables difficult conversations, culture change, and strategic decisions. It's essential for sustainability, especially as the sector faces rising cost and shifting expectations.
Now, next up, maintenance grants are back, Gary.
I know, it's always nice when, I mean, I haven't been reading speeches in 2015, Jim, but he's a blast from the past. So Bridget Phillipson got to stage this week and announced that maintenance grants were back, which was not expected. Obviously, listeners and readers will know that the international student levy has been floated previously, but now we get a sense about where it's going. Bridget announced that for courses that were consistent with the government's vision, its plan for change, and its views about the skills that the nation needs, so courses like STEM, architecture, but not landscape engineering, Jib, they're very clear on that, that the government would introduce maintenance grants. We're not clear yet on the amount. We're not clear yet on the eligibility. Some would say that Bridget was running for the deputy leadership and needed an announcement. But it's good. I mean, isn't it nice to think about something which is a policy that actually people can go, that is decent. But of course, there are questions about how the levy will fall across the sector. UK have been very clear that it is a good policy funded in a bad way. They're not the only one commenting on that. But more detail will come at the budget in November. You know, there's a lot riding on the budget, but it's genuinely news from the Education Secretary this week.
Conference, the Tories treated our amazing universities as a political battleground, not a public good. Labour is putting them back in the service of working class young people. Last year, I took the decisive steps we needed on university finances. So opportunity is there tomorrow for all who want it. But I know, you know, that we must do more. So that is why today I'm announcing that this Labour government will introduce new targeted maintenance grants for students who need them most.
Now, Eve, my grant check lies over the ocean. My grant check lies over the sea. My grant check lies over the ocean. But I study history, so it won't be for me.
Yeah, basically. So let me just set the scene of how I found out about this right at conference. In a panel on student funding, Alex Stanley, VP HE at NUS, was on the panel and sort of grabbed the mic mid-panel and was like, I've just been told that they've just announced maintenance grants are coming back. There was a massive round of applause in the room. And I was like, oh my God, this is what it feels like to have a like positive and really exciting HE policy that will benefit students. And I was like, oh my God, I've forgotten what this feels like.
And then I'm reading Slack and it's like, oh, they're funding it through the international levy.
Yeah, basically. So then I was like, oh my God, okay, funded by the levy, not good, dagger to the heart. Then, oh wait, it's actually only certain subjects. That's pretty frustrating, though perhaps predictable, given that that's kind of what that mechanism is. They've done that in LLE as well. And then, Jim, I saw you and you were like, let's be clear. It's not actually abundantly clear whether this is like new money or whether it's going to be displacing loan allowance already. So I was taught a lesson not to be joyful at any announcements because there's probably some horrible small print. Yeah, look, I feel less concerned about the restriction to particular subjects in the first instance, not least because they've done that with LLE. It's quite sort of familiar thing for this government to be doing, but also because I perhaps naively believe Jackie Smith's comments when in the Fringe, when she said that she implied that this was where they were going to start with the money that they could identify right now, with the implication being that, you know, hopefully it would be expanded more in the future, TBC, but I'm willing to believe that right now. What I think is interesting is that, like, politically from the perspective of the sector, it is quite difficult to argue against this just because you don't like the way it's being funded, though obviously that won't stop the sector, understandably. But the thing that I wonder is whether the government have shot themselves in the foot slightly by effectively linking the sort of fate of getting working class young people into HE with the continued success of international student recruitment. And the latter has been, you know, subject to consistent sort of policy restrictions in the last 5 years. We have a sort of imminent international education strategy that I can't imagine is going to be like, we've got a massive big new target for international student recruitment. So I'd love to know what their modelling looks like for what the levy will do on international student recruitment sort of demand and how that will affect the ability and the sort of breadth of being able to roll out maintenance grants to those who need it.
Michael, I guess there is a specific difference between Bridget wanting something important to go in her speech, not being able to get any money out of Rachel, and therefore, you know, being able to announce this and actual hypothecation by the time we get to the budget, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, by the budget or even by the end of the parliament is what she said they want. That's the target for grants to come back in. It's going to be, you know, in imposing a fee levy is going to be very complicated. It will require primary legislation. It will have, you know, consultation. It will have delays. It will just have general kind of fiddly implementation challenges. If that is the, you know, the premise of grants, then grants not coming back particularly soon. I think, you know, if you're a 16, 17 year old getting ready for university and sort of being pleased about the news, you shouldn't be. That's not you. It's your younger sister. Yeah. I think just on what Eve was saying also about this thing about, you know, so they've said maintenance grants will be fully funded by the international fee levy. That doesn't mean, I mean, it may mean, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the full levy funding is going towards maintenance grants. You know, they may well want to do something else with it. They will certainly want to leave plenty that just sort of, you know, sloshing around in DfE's budgets. They'll probably sort of ring fence some that they're confident of getting and start with these sort of small targeted grants. Yeah, but I think that's the thing to pay attention to. And also, we don't know what the levy percentage, the quantum, is going to be. The only thing we've had out of government, they've never commented on it further, but the only thing we've seen is that in the immigration white paper annex, they modelled what 6% would do. I mean, they also modelled it incredibly poorly, but that's sort of by the by. But yeah, they put 6 in there, but it could well be a different number when the time comes, and it could change as the years roll by as well. Something to pay attention to.
Gary, the thing is, right, if I'm an international student at Durham, I already see a chunk of my fee income redistributed away into bursaries for poorer kids at Durham. So, you know, there is some redistribution going on within institutions of fee income already via access and participation plans. But the thing is, you know, when I looked at this earlier on in the year, right, on average, in the Russell Group, the cash per head to students getting, you know, kind of money in their bank via kind of bursaries and stuff was 2,300 quid. But in million plus providers, it was 726 quid. So doesn't this just move money around the sector rather than move money around the institution? Doesn't it just make the distribution of the money that some students put in to subsidize others a bit fairer?
Well, I mean, fair is a subjective term, isn't it, Jim? It certainly does it. Whether it's fair or not sort of depends on where you sit in. And I'm sitting in Durham. So I think that one of the unintended consequences of this is going to be that some of the assumptions we made when, as a sector, when we were devising APP, our submissions to OFS for access and our broader strategies for access and participation, a massive variable has changed. You know, John Blake must be furious. And because we don't know the amount and we don't know the distribution particularly well yet, it's really hard to understand what the effect of that will be. But, you know, we've done some brilliant work at Durham in terms of our Durham grant and making sure that it is a good level going in the right places. And it just occurs to me this is going to be work for the sector. The things that occurred to me from what you said, Jim, is that it is certainly a challenge, the word I want to use. It's a challenge to institutional autonomy, I suppose, isn't it? That institutions were used to thinking, our money will come in, we will decide where it goes to best advantage to further our strategy. What Bridget announced is that to further our strategy of skills in the right place on the right courses, we're going to be doing some redistribution for you. And the money will come off your interest students. And as Michael said, maybe not all the money will go into the maintenance grant. I am really interested in how the per capita allocation will be affected by this, because you're absolutely right that the money that goes into million plus institutions, for example, that do a lot of the heavy lifting on student support when students arrive at university, need a lot. I mean, what I will say in defense of the Russell Group is that they do an awful lot of the work in schools, and they do an awful lot of the work for aspirations, particularly in large rural counties like County Durham, where we do a heck of a lot of work with the County Durham FE colleges and with other charitable bodies. And we don't all, you know, and we don't see the benefit for a lot of it in the sense that they don't come to Durham, but the nation does, because they do go to HE. And I do think that is probably something to reflect on, that a lot of access work isn't just money in students' pockets. It is a lot of that. Of course it is, in terms of the money to live on, but it isn't just that. So I do think that the fairness side of it sort of depends upon where you're sitting. And access, this isn't the only thing that institutions should spend their money on when it comes to access work.
Michael, in the run-up, there were a few things, weren't there? But Public First put some stuff out that basically said, look, not only is this going to cost universities hundreds of millions of quid, but it will reduce place for domestic students. Is that a credible prediction?
I mean, it's certainly possible. I think there's a case whether the government really sort of buys that argument, which I'm not sure. I mean, we certainly, going back to the sort of high tariff question, we've seen at least a couple of, you know, summers and beyond, really, where, you know, universities have shown themselves extremely willing to recruit the marginal home student, right? I mean, they might be able to say, here's the track data, this is the loss we're making overall. But I'm not sure they've made the case to government that they're, you know, that when their international numbers fall, they are also proportionally reducing home students. Even if we, you know, if we look at these sort of aggregate levels of things, that as Public First has done, then you can sort of make that argument. Does the government believe it? I'm not sure. I mean, probably the bigger question is, does this drive an English university or more over the cliff? Because that obviously immediately affects all of the home students currently studying there, all of the ones who are wanting to, you know, it creates all kinds of problems. It could have, you know, these sort of knock-on effects about sort of contagion and sort of, you know, banks not wanting to lend anymore that we've talked about. You know, that's the question more than, you know, do universities go, you know, okay, fewer international students, all right, I'm doing less research then, or I'm taking fewer hung students. I mean, that's not really quite how the sector's set up, but these sort of aggregate level things are reflected on at an institutional level.
Eve, if we, you know, there are parts of the UK that still have, you know, non-repayable grants in the mix of, you know, the kind of total that you get to support your living costs. And the perception I get is that, you know, from a sort of student point of view, you know, people are focused on the amount of money in their bank account. And whatever happens with these targeted maintenance grants, students are still going to graduate with a big, you know, kind of bill that they've got to repay to the student loans company. Is this much more about political symbolism than it is about, you know, how important the mix of grant and loan is for a student?
I don't think it's just necessarily political symbolism. And again, call me naive, but when I've heard Jackie Smith speak previously, I think she genuinely cares about the sort of pound in the pocket of students. But the thing that's interesting to me, I saw on my TikTok, I think it was literally just this morning or possibly last night, parent and a prospective student really worried about the debt that they might graduate with post-university on Martin Lewis's show. And the question from the parent was effectively, if I have the money, should I pay for her tuition loans? And in the brilliant way that Martin Lewis does, he very clearly says, unless you've got loads of money where you can do that and then also have money spare to protect your student against other more difficult forms of debt, then it's not worth it. And I would just love to see better messaging around the loans and the debt that you accrue to reduce the concern from students. I say that as a former student, you know, students union officer, who also heard from students this massive concern about debt. But it's so interesting to me, the level of concern versus the sort of like reality of what that actually means for a student. And so I think maintenance costs is absolutely the right place to start if you're government. And then also if they are to index the tuition fee in line with inflation moving forward, then they've got this to point to say, we care about the everyday pound in the pocket of students. But yeah, better messaging around the latter, around the debt would help, I think.
But Gary, this has always been the kind of ultimate puzzle, hasn't it? Because if you're a government and you push the loan scheme to look and sound more like a loan, then, you know, what you're talking about is debt. And what you need to be able to do is signal that you might at some point be able to pay it off. And both of those are very difficult. On the other hand, if you push it towards it being a graduate tax, oh my God, the government's putting taxes up. That nothing about this announcement relieves that central ongoing sort of Martin Lewis money saving expert explanation problem, does it?
No, but I think I was taken in the totality, I think, of what ministers were saying at conference, which was that there is, I think, a growing realization that the media filter through which things fit is never reliable and not particularly well disposed towards the Labour Party. I think it is people are able to access their own news and understand their own pockets and their lives much better. And I always think that what Martin Lewis and you know, other good journalists do very well is understand that people will have some experience, or they're not just going to believe a fairy tale. They have to be able to connect it to their lives. So people understanding it as a loan or tax or whatever, people will look at their own bank balances and their money. And I think the announcement of maintenance grants is students will see money still, and they will have some understanding that this is just money they don't have to pay back. I think it's really possible to understand how people view loans or taxes as if everybody sees it that way. You know, we see that there is always a large proportion of people who will understand things differently to how we expect. So I don't think it's a perfect announcement. There's going to be an awful lot of the communication that will need to be refined. But we're going to see in November, you know, that the country is going to be looking at Rachel Reeves at the dispatch box. Because she's, you know, they will be thinking she's talking about VAT, she'll be talking about income taxes, national insurance. Like, there's a lot riding on that. And all I'm expecting is that she will have 30 seconds where she will say, we will put money in students' pockets, which they will not have to pay back. It will go to the working class people to do lifelong valuable education. And that's going to be pretty powerful.
Now, finally, this week, we thought we'd look at the vibes. Eve, you're all about the vibes.
Purely vibes-based. Yeah, Labour conference was an interesting one, I think, this year. Like, so, you know, it was always going to be an important moment for the government. They needed to quietened doubts about Keir's leadership. They needed to come up with some sort of reform plan. And I mean the sort of Nigel Farage reform plan. There was, I think, quite a lot of pressure. And interestingly, I thought it was more successful than I thought it might be for them. The thing that I think landed most well, both with the sort of conference attendees, but also the broader public, was Keir's messaging around reform and the idea that, you know, reform don't love this country, and that kind of patriotism, which I hadn't heard from them to that extent previously, and I think set a really good tone and got cut through. In terms of sort of the HE sector at the conference, I've spoken to various people about this before, but I really worry about what I see as a sort of slight lack of self-awareness that the sector has, particularly within those spaces, but perhaps more broadly with government. But one of the things that I really sort of reflected on when I was traveling back was that I think increasingly we think of the HE sector as a sector, as a sort of standalone sector, and we have all our fringe events and conferences and all that kind of stuff. But really, the functions that HE providers do mean that it's much more accurate to view our sector as sort of spanning all of the other sectors that are also present at a conference like Labour Conference. And I just started to think, what would it look like if one year the sector together just decided that instead of going to all of the kind of, you know, classic things that they do at sector conferences that we all put on, that we actually just all dispersed out into the fringes on industry and the NHS and healthcare and, you know, all of those other sectors to really symbolise the fact that HE institutions are engines for progress on all of those other things. So I hope that we will be able to more effectively make that message sort of post white paper and how we respond to government vision. But I think in spaces like Labour Conference, the sector is always at a danger of talking to itself and being, you know, an echo chamber effectively.
Gary, I think this is a great point, right? So I went to a few fringes which were really talking about, you know, place and community and social cohesion, you know, those sorts of things. And the week before, the government had launched this big strategy, this Pride in Place strategy. And as well as pumping a load of money into kind of left behind areas, there's a kind of huge strategy which involves a bit of communitarianism and community groups and charities and so on. And it's, you know, it's long, it's substantial. Some of it's got some really interesting policy ideas in there, came out of, you know, communities and local government week before conference. And guess who's not mentioned. Now, you know, I guess there's two ways we can read that, aren't there? One is, you know, this is classic departmental siloing. If you work in the housing and communities government in that team, you're probably not thinking about universities and colleges every day. But there is something else here, isn't there, about, you know, in the mind of government and in the mind of the public, universities being something, you know, at the top of a hill, not in a place.
Yeah, I think there's a few things on that in the interest, mate. One of which is the new Secretary of State wrote what was actually a really unusually personal foreword to the Pride in Place strategy, where it spoke about how all of his family were made, lost their jobs when the printing works in Watford closed. It's something that really chides me because I come from Longbridge, where the car factory closed, and I had exactly the same thing. The family went, we all went for critical meals. It was devastating. And what struck me about that was the extent to which, when that happens, Labour politicians of a certain age, people who are making decisions now, were affected by industry. You know, it's the Labour Party. And actually, the things that affected them, the scars that they have, the wrongs they're trying to right, come from industrial failure, not educational failure. Education was the solution for very many people. But, you know, Steve Reed spoke about industry. And actually, the Pride in Place strategy really speaks about the way in which, when that failure occurs, what happens is faith. You know, faith came through so strongly as faith-based groups, as things they see as part of the solution. Things like music and sport, football was in there massively. Education wasn't. I was also taken by the extent to which the opening of the report spoke about, it's not just statistics, it's got to be vibes that we look in. Interesting that I don't think that's where I think investment will actually follow statistics rather than feelings. Yeah. But they did say this with that no amount of statistics will change some of the narrative. And, you know, Keir certainly spoke about flags famously
has contributed to that. But I was really interested that the places where I grew up wouldn't be classed as a deprived area because the statistical analysis wouldn't show students. So Selly Oak in Birmingham, massively student population in there. A lot of the people there wouldn't get some of the Pride in Place funding because it wouldn't show up in the right way. But they will be places that lack the sports facilities, the faith groups that build community, the green spaces, the music and arts facilities. And higher education won't be viewed as part of the solution to that because they're not providing those social goods in the same way. But of course they are, because a lot of the student organisations and academic and professional populations that will be cutting the oranges, running the raffles that Keir spoke about, will be the people who have the middle class time and social capital to be doing those sorts of things in the government's vision. I do think one of the challenges is to understand that the Labour Party politicians that wrote the strategies that we're making the decisions are viewing the half-time orange cutting as something that working class communities do. Like, it's not about trying to see universities as places of middle class. It's full of working class people people like me, who are still doing those things. And I realize that they're not different and they're not opposite. They are actually the same thing. But it's just a shame, I suppose, that admission happened. But I do think it's an understandable one.
But I mean, more broadly, Michael, and we kind of discussed this on Policy Radar the other day, didn't we? You know, this was broadly a sector that had heard that it's all about economic growth and turned up at conference this week to talk about the role of universities in economic growth. And, you know, I mean, my sense about Labour conference this week is that, you know, on head and heart, on kind of head and heart, it is true that the government wants to make economic growth a central mission and it's, you know, the antidote to reform and all of that kind of stuff. But in heart terms, place, community, social cohesion, you know, some of the stuff that's been happening on, you know, race and reform and so on, you know, that's really the sort of, you know, the emotional driver for the party, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. But I would just caution that, you know, the party isn't the government. I mean, we can say, you know, 6 months ago, the government was very focused on growth and industrial strategy, and those things were not central concerns of the conference. But equally, you know, in a few months' time, we can say, oh, the government's really focused on productivity and things like that. Why was no one talking about that at the conference? The conference is, you know, what the party talks about. There's sort of, you know, there's the motions, there's the members, there's the unions that aren't, you know. So I caution about sort of too much, you know, the sector thinking it's sort of talking about the wrong thing.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. If chat of this sort is your bag, don't forget our Festival of Higher Education is on in November. Thefestivalofhe.com is where you need to go to grab your ticket. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE more generally, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Gary, Eve, Michael, Salmon for making the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.